Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Great to have you along. We're on Twitter, of course, at KUOW. Join along. We are going to figure out what happened this week, what's about to happen, maybe, on Tuesday, and why it all matters. With our panel, my friends, Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail, former Seattle Times opinion writer. Joni Balter, welcome.
Hello.
Natalie Brand, political reporter at King 5. You're finished taking a swig of water, so welcome.
Welcome. Thanks
for
having us.
Just vamping a little bit so you could really, you know, get ready. C.R. Douglas, political analyst, Q13 News. Hiya.
Good afternoon.
So, Tuesday is election day, which in our state means election deadline. Which one's more fun? Election day, which sounds like a holiday, or election deadline, which sounds like you're in trouble because your ballot's been sitting on your table for weeks and you're lazy and pathetic.
And then it's going to go sit on the tables at the election office when they count them, kind of slowly.
Slowly. Anyway, that's how we do elections. You have to mail in your ballot or drop it in a box by Tuesday. One big choice on the Seattle ballot, of course, is the job of mayor. And this has been a campaign, but not just a campaign. It's been an emotional ordeal, really, since Mayor Ed Murray was accused of sexually abusing his foster son and other young men. And Murray denies all of that, but he's out of office. We've had two mayors since then, and we've had this campaign between two candidates who call themselves progressive, two candidates who've never held elective office. It's really been something else. And what have we learned? What have we learned from all this, Natalie?
I mean, this is a saga that really started in the spring with so many different twists and turns and people entering this race during primary season. We had 21 candidates.
Right.
And now the big question is, where do the supporters of those past frontrunner primary candidates go? We are down to Jenny Durkin, former U.S. attorney, and Carrie Moon, urban planner. And only about 13% of the vote is in at this point from Seattle.
Is that unusually low?
It's a little lower, but the trend lately has been people are holding on to their ballots for longer. So King County election still projecting 48% turnout, but right now we are at 13%. I checked in with both campaigns yesterday, and they are still sensing across both sides a large number of still undecided voters.
Undecided voters. Anybody have an idea what those voters might be weighing?
Well, they're looking at it. They're looking at a race where they don't really know these candidates very well. These are not household names, either of them. And, you know, this is a campaign. There's been plenty of debates. It's not like there's everyone in this of us have hosted.
All four of us
have hosted them.
Yeah, mine was more of a conversation, but
Was more of a conversation, but happened to be on the same day as yours. It turns into a debate when they start going.
Indeed.
And so there's been a lot of information about it, but I'll add to that the fact that we have a lot of new people in Seattle, and they aren't sure about them. They don't know enough yet. Maybe they're waiting for late breaking news. I think this is a really interesting race. There was somebody, we were on this show one time, who thought the race was really slow and boring. I think these candidates are really different. Their politics are quite different on a lot of different
issues. Quite different. Okay, we're going to get into that. CR?
I think it started slow and it's gotten more interesting. I mean, September was a little uneventful and even early October, but it's definitely ramped up. What you find when you hear these candidates in the last couple of weeks, and I did a debate just on Tuesday, is how much more aggressive they are getting with each other. I also did one-on-ones with them last week, and boy, they were taking on their opponent like I haven't seen yet so far in the campaign, which suggests that this is closer than probably either of them want it to be. But the ramp up has gotten pretty interesting. I mean, Jenny Durkin said to me about Carrie Moon, quote, "She is funding and writing her own check. She has paid her way into this election." And here's Carrie Moon talking to me just last week, quote, "She," meaning Jenny Durkin, "she is always protecting the current wealth inequality that we have." So this is stronger rhetoric than we've seen. They sort of played nice all summer and early fall. And it's, I wouldn't say nasty, but I would say it's aggressive.
Well, this, I don't know if it's an accusation. Somebody self-funding a campaign is perfectly above board,
it's actually,
right?
So it's actually allowed.
It's allowed. So, you know, what is Durkin trying to say, that the election system ought to be different from what it is, or that Carrie Moon has somehow abused it? What's the conversation?
Well, She's not calling for reforms, but she is pointing it out that, listen, her campaign, meaning Durkin's campaign, has a lot more contributors. I don't know, close to 4,000 at this
4,400, I believe. Is
and the, I think Carrie Moon's at about 1,000. So it does, you know, there is a case to be made that the more contributors you have, the broader it looks. And that's what Durkin's trying to point out.
Okay.
Now, of course, money is an issue for both sides, because Durkin has raised a ton of money and there is a sense that she's kind of, you know, got a lot of corporate establishment support, if she will. She certainly has the chamber full behind her. They're doing an independent expenditure campaign of, what, $700,000-$800,000. So there are money critiques that both sides are leveling at each other.
Well, there was one story that was in our little packet to prepare for today that I thought was just plain silly. The headline was, Durkin draws record donations, comma, continued Republican support. Sort of a call 911. Jenny Durkin has located at least the three of the Republicans who live in Seattle, which mm-hmm. is probably the full tally there. What they're both doing is simply attacking the way that each is running their campaign and the way that they're funding it. That's what you do when you're maybe you don't think you landed the right point on an issue or something like that. So CR's right. Individual contributions say something. They say more people support you than this other person who's self-funding to a big degree. You know, these candidates, they started slow, I think, because they wanted to be sort of different than, frankly, two guys running against each other. But also, that was at a time where I didn't think either of them had any exemplary debate skills. They've gotten better, sharper, drawing distinctions between them. And they actually have both gotten better because they spent so much time together discussing these issues. And they've had to sort of draw each other out on some and challenging each other. And some of them have stumbled a little bit, like, you know, this whole right to shelter business. Yes, I'm for it. Well, this is what it means. And you're.
This is whether shelter should be not just a human right, but a legal right written into Seattle law.
As in an ordinance. Yeah. And so that's where Carrie Moon maybe had to take that one back.
Mm. So back to the money piece for a second. I think it's important to draw the distinction between the outside spending, which is where the Moon campaign is criticizing Durkin for having the backing of the Chamber of Commerce's Political Action Committee, you know, calling her the corporate candidate, which you hear voters repeat that, you know, phrase when you talk to moon-leaning voters out in the field. But here are the individual donations that we were just talking about. And what's interesting, so I printed out...
You have some packets.
I have some packets. So I have for both candidates. And if you see the employers that are still, you know, the people, the employees who are contributing to campaigns, at the top, in the top five of both, across both sides, Durkin and Moon, is Amazon, which Jenny Durkin has way more Amazon money, but Carrie Moon also has Amazon employees helping to fund her campaign, which shows this maybe potential divide between the business side and the tech side. But it's like some of the key players and some of the large corporations, the employees of those corporations are supporting both candidates.
And that's the way it's been for a long time. Sometimes you have corporations that say, you know, we're gonna back heavily the candidate that we really want, but we're not going to be caught unconnected to the other candidate just in case they win.
One thing that's interesting is the closer you get to an election, you kind of get a sense from the candidates about what they're most worried about. And it's pretty clear Jenny Durkin is sensitive on this homeless issue. You know, I asked it a couple different times at the debate on Tuesday, and they each had two challenge cards, which is this kind of thing we do in debates.
Contrivance.
Anytime you can get up and just challenge what your other said. So for
the visual.
For this 90-minute debate, they each had two challenge cards. Well, Jenny Durkin used them both on one question. Mm-hmm. I mean, I asked about this homeless sweeps and the kind of the homeless thing, and
she doesn't call them sweeps.
She doesn't call them sweeps, but she challenged Carrie Moon twice on that issue because Carrie Moon leveled a lot of attacks at her. So she's clearly defensive on that. I mean, Carrie Moon is very clear that she wants those sweeps to stop, certainly slow them down. She is more alive with the activists, if you will, the sort of homeless community.
Who were at City Hall this week, marking the second anniversary.
Who were at City Hall this week,
of the state of emergency.
But that's one big distinction between them too, as well. For the should homeless be allowed to camp in the parks? They, you know, Carrie Moon is for that short term. Jenny Durkin says she's against.
Yeah, so the sweeps is a you know, Jenny Durkin doesn't want to call them sweeps, doesn't want to be associated with that label, but, you know, basically she is supportive of the current city policy, which is they are moving people out of encampments. I think it's clear they're doing it more humanely and more justly than they were even a few months ago. But that is a big divide. I mean, homelessness is right at the top of voters' agenda in terms of priorities, and you got two different approaches you can go with.
And the
Durkin
talking point is the focus should not be on keeping people in those environments, but shifting them to better homes.
And she's got a big plan for more shelters and that kind of stuff.
How about people who do have homes? Between Durkin and Moon, what are their differences when it comes to how they would like to rezone, upzone, add multifamily, change the character, that whole debate we've been having in Seattle?
Well, I feel like that is one big distinction between them. Not that they've been crystal clear on this, but I think if you're thinking about single-family neighborhoods, it's far more likely that Carrie Moon will upzone bigger portions of the city than Jenny Durkin, even though I don't have exact specific quotes that tell you this. Just listening to them in debates or listening them on the radio, for that matter, you get that very clear.
Well, Moon does have a target. She wants to quadruple the amount of affordable housing online. So that would come across upzoning, building more, you know, you name it.
Yeah, and I asked him about this actually on Tuesday about single family zoning and where you at on that. How much would you mess around with it to increase density? And they both, I mean, listen, at a macro level, Durkin is doing all she can to make inroads into the progressive left. So she's
did we ban all, progressive
she's
on
kind
this
of
show?
Throwing all kinds of bones that way. So on single family zoning, she actually went there. I mean, she said, "Yeah, we gotta change that. We gotta do a lot more backyard cottages and duplexes and triplexes." So I think in general, Joni's right. Moon would probably be the one that would mess around with that kind of zoning more. But Jenny Durkin is not carrying the torch for single family neighborhoods, at least not in her rhetoric. I think she realizes that would be, you know, that's not a way to get the left.
Yeah, but a distinction here, backyard cottages, we've talked about that for a very long time, and a lot of people are for that. That's different than saying block by block, if we could say block by block, that you will be upzoning significantly.
But she did talk about duplexes and triplexes and you know, encroaching into single-family neighborhoods.
Before we leave policy, I imagine voters are trying to figure out which one of these candidates is going to make the city a better place, going to make my life better. We talked about their contributions. We talked money. We talked homeless policy. We talked upzoning and changing zoning in Seattle housing. Give me one more difference between Durkin and Moon for the voter.
Broadband, municipal broadband, and then which is something Moon is pushing for. Durkin says the math doesn't work out. And this is where you go back to Moon will attack Durkin for being funded in outside money by groups, including Comcast. You know, Durkin says she has her own plan. Did this come up at your debate?
Yeah, it did.
As
and, there,
well?
And there is a divide there over broadband. I think you're right. Moon would push that.
Very good.
And taxes, I think.
Yeah, there's, I would just...
There's a difference in the taxes that they discuss and sort of in the way they relate to Seattleites, many of whom feel that the property tax especially has been going up just by voter-approved measures over and over.
And I would just second that. I think taxation as a kind of theme is a difference. I mean, Moon is clearly the one that pushes harder and has more rhetoric about having the wealthier pay more, changing the tax structure, talks about a capital gains tax, talks about, you know, a higher business and occupation tax. Durkin is more of a hold the line on taxes, no new taxes. So that is a difference.
And Durkin's critique is that a lot of Moon's proposals would involve needing to go to Olympia and getting approval by state lawmakers, which is not necessarily an immediate solution.
Mm-hmm. But one of the tussles coming with the city council is clearly over the head tax, or it's been called the Amazon tax. And there are something like almost four votes hovering around five on the city council. And you have to think about how these two candidates will interact with this new city council.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be a humdinger, if you want my opinion.
Both candidates at this point saying that they're opposed to the
Correct.
Current formula
Right.
of that tax.
Right.
We're talking about the election to come. Maybe you've mailed your ballot. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you're filling it out as you're listening to the Week in Review on KUOW. We've got Natalie Brand and C.R. Douglas and Joni Balter. One last question before we leave the mayoral race. Joni, you brought up the candidates wanting to be different from two guys running. The Seattle political consultant Kathy Allen says the shock that many Seattleites felt when Hillary Clinton lost to Trump might help explain us having two women mayoral candidates to choose from. Anybody believe that?
Well, if you look beyond Seattle, we have two female mayoral candidates in Everett. We have a female mayoral candidate in Tacoma who made it through the primary. We have two women running in LD45. So, I mean, there's no question that we are going to have more females elected to office after this election day.
But I guess I would point out that that is the tradition of Washington State. For something like 9 years, Washington had the highest percentage of women in the legislature, something we often traded with Maine going back a while. We have two female U.S. senators. Remember when Governor Gregoire was there? So that we were the only state that had two female U.S. senators and a female governor.
Since then, Kathy Allen would argue that we kind of lost ground.
We did in the legislature. The percentages
seems
dropped.
Maybe there seems to be an uptick.
I don't know how much you can point to causation of Trump, although Monica Dingra, who is running over in the 45th, I have heard her say that Trump got her into this race. So there may be.
I think Jenny Durkin says that.
Does Teresa Mosqueda. So, running in position 8. So.
Well, let's talk about that East Side Senate campaign, because this is going to decide the balance of the power in the Senate. Democrats have the majority in the House, and of course they have the governorship. What's most important to voters about this East Side Senate campaign? This is Redmond, is it Kirkland, Sammamish, Woodinville? Big
think
chunk
of the neighborhood as Microsoft.
Yeah.
When you talk to Republicans, capital gains, I think that's what's really going to be at stake potentially next year, and what they're talking about. They're talking about taxes, and you know the Democratic Party's talking about pushing through some of their more progressive things that they'd like to get done, and less obstruction.
They're also talking about Trump. I mean, the interesting thing is that this is the one partisan race actually on the ballot. You know, these off years, we have city and county elections, and they're all nonpartisan, basically. Mm. So we do have a special election here. And so it's the one that we all cover that you're really hearing the kind of national themes. I mean, the anti-Trumpism and the tax and spend liberalism. I mean, that's being thrown about. It's not just another legislative race. That's why it is getting so much attention. It will decide the balance of power in Olympia.
At least for a year.
The state Senate, which has been controlled by Republicans for several years now, is only a one vote majority for the GOP. So if they lose this seat, then the Democrats take that. They already have the House. They, of course, have the governor's mansion. So every interest group imaginable is in this race, both endorsing and with money and all kinds of
national
things.
Groups, millions of dollars.
They know that a more liberal Democratic agenda is very likely if the Democrats win this seat.
So to point this out here, this is the last Republican state legislative body on the West Coast. So that's another part of all the interest.
The West Coast would be solid blue on the map.
Correct, and just by this one vote. So that's what's so interesting about it. In addition, and I moderated a debate on this over at Microsoft, and these are two new candidates. Very few people know much about them. It was a really interesting debate, and I thought one thing that was interesting.
You said their names in a while, Monica Dingra
and
Jin Young Lee England.
Yes.
And so one thing I noticed as we were hosting this is that Jin Young, the Republican there, was very much running against the city of Seattle. Danny Westnate wrote a really interesting column about this. And I've always wondered about this strategy, because if you talk to those folks, if you meet them somewhere else and you ask them where they're from, they're going to say they're from Seattle, not from the East Side so much. They identify with Seattle. So I wonder if that works. And I wonder what Seattle did so wrong to kind of deserve that.
But. Well, you see a lot of that. The momentum behind that talking point coming after the Amazon announcement a few weeks ago. So
Democrats are generally more excited because the Democrat did better in the primary here by about 10 points. It's also been a district that has trended blue over the years. I mean, The other two representatives in the district that are in the House are both Democrats. If you look at, you know, some kind of litmus test votes, if you will, I mean, they went for Hillary Clinton. If you just take that district, they went for Barack Obama. They've gone for Jay Inslee. So there's a tailwind for the Democrat here that they're excited about. But it's also, you know, it's got some moderate fiscal narratives too, and I think some of the Iman initiatives have actually won there. So it's not just a open season for the Democrats.
But it was Clinton by a lot in that district, so I think that's one indication of how this might.
However, fall. It's a little different when you look at the state and local races, because there is a lot of ticket splitting, but, you know, voting for the statewide Republican candidate in that district.
Predictions, mayor and East Side.
I wouldn't make a prediction. I can't make a prediction.
Okay.
It's too close. We haven't seen any
polling. You can't
polling.
Because you don't know. You can't because you're not allowed to make
polling
predictions.
Polling in the mayoral race. I mean, it's. I think if you talk to any analyst in this town, it's hard to say.
I'm not going to make an outright prediction. I still think that Durkin probably has the advantage. She still has the most money, the most momentum. I think she's run probably the better campaign. I think she's grown more as a candidate. She was pretty bad as a speaker, pretty lawyerly, pretty wonkish. She's gotten so much better. Carrie Moon started pretty good. I would say she's sort of still pretty good. So the growth of Durkin has been a lot better, and she's had pretty good ads. And it still is the case that the establishment candidate more often than not wins.
And I will say campaign infrastructure, you know, volunteer support and ground game. Durkin's definitely has that for hand when it comes to that.
I want to say Carrie Moon's done an impressive thing, but I still think the advantage is probably slightly Durkin.
In talking to Moon yesterday, she thinks it's going to come down to younger voters, the youth vote.
I'll second that. I think if you had to predict this race, you'd say Jenny Durkin wins. But the new voters, the ones who are going to vote this weekend and right up to the deadline so that we can wait, you know, forever for the ballots to be counted, could be for Carrie Moon because of that word that I thought you banned here.
More the P word?
They're both progressive, but one is more progressive.
How about Dingra versus England?
I would give the Democrat the advantage just because the demographics in that district have changed so much.
And
the Ds are just doing well on every other part of the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a Democrat's year and a Democrat's advantage there for sure.
Well, and when it comes to the ground game, the support, the momentum, I mean, they want that seat. They are fighting for it. They are in the streets and on the ground for sure.
Okay, final is if you could pick one final word about the ballot, because there are other elections on there. What's one thing we highlighted the ones that are already getting the most attention?
Annoying.
Final word.
Annoying because of the Urquhart race.
Annoying. Oh, the Urquhart. Yeah, this is King County Sheriff. Why annoying?
Because it shouldn't be on the ballot. That shouldn't be an elective office. Wow. Look at the mess.
Hmm.
I don't actually mind it being an elected office, but it is a mess. This is
what,
the ugliest
mess?
Race
is
by
the,
far.
Is that what you're looking for, mess?
Yeah. this is by far the ugliest race of the year. All kinds of back and forth and rape allegations and sexual groping allegations and all kinds of stuff. And it's been hard to cover, actually. It's been hard to cover because there's a lot of back and forth on this one.
We're just a few seconds before. We're half past the hour. We're going to talk about these new revelations in Olympia. Any last word, Natalie?
Voters have a lot to research. Yeah. There's a lot of open seats. There's a lot of, for an off year, if you haven't started studying, you need to spend this weekend with your voters pamphlet and doing online research, reading all of our work, because there's a lot to look at.
Hey, you're snowed in because there's a few flakes on the ground. So take that time for yourself. It's you time. It's ballot time. And this is Week in Review time on KUOW. Back in just a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. What's your reaction to our discussion? We're on Twitter at KUOW. We've got the host of Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter. We've got King 5 political reporter Natalie Brand, Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas, and we're talking about the top stories of this week. There have always been men who sexually harass, grope, rape, women, and now we are hearing about it more than ever. This week, 9 Washington State women told our Northwest News Network that men have sexually harassed them or touched them inappropriately while they were working at the state capitol in Olympia within the past decade. One of them is former state representative from Seattle, Jessen Farrell. She says a male lobbyist walking down a hallway patted her on the behind.
I was shocked that it happened in the workplace, and you know, I also felt a little ashamed. I think so often with these stories and these things that happen, women internalize it. You know, that initial thought was, did I do something wrong? And, you know, obviously I didn't, but that is a thought that crossed my mind in that moment. And then it was to just move on. You know, this is just, these things happen and just get back to work.
We also learned this week about a state legislator who had suddenly resigned 6 years ago. Democratic State Representative Jim Jacks of Vancouver didn't say why he was leaving the legislature so abruptly. The House Majority Leader, Pat Sullivan, wouldn't say either. He just talked about issues.
This is, you know, an institution that always has issues.
Right.
But there were no issues that forced Representative Jacks to resign. There were issues that he was dealing with that led to his decision.
Issues. Well, yesterday we found out that at least one issue is that a legislative staffer accused Jacks of behaving inappropriately toward her at a St. Patrick's Day celebration. And our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, has since learned more. Austin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So it turned out it's more than the one accuser you told us about yesterday. What do we know?
That's right. I spoke to Jim Jacks' former legislative assistant, who agreed to talk. She did not agree to be identified by name, but she said she worked for him in 2009, and she said that while she worked for him as his legislative assistant, he sexually harassed her. She said that he called her a hottie and a groupie, that he would stare at her breasts and, quote, just acted inappropriately. She also said that he, at one point, cornered her in his office or got her in his office, closed the door at a time when nobody else was around, and sexually propositioned her and said that he could help her career. She said she reported this to first to a liaison for the House Democratic Caucus staff who dealt with the LAs. She wanted confidentiality at that point, but she wanted out of there. She said nothing happened, so she submitted her resignation. And at that point, they said, you need to go talk to the chief clerk of the House. She did that. She also talked to the chief of staff for the House Democratic Caucus at that time. She said that they expressed concern, but didn't help her, didn't get her into a new position. And she said she finally left that job, a job she needed, upset, mad, and feeling like she had not been taken care of in a time of need.
And for those who haven't heard us talk about this, there are other women accusing Jacks of a variety of outrageous behavior. Can you give us an idea?
Yeah, we've heard, you know, these stories have been around for a long time, and there was always a mystery, but maybe not much of one, about what led to his sudden mid-session departure 6 years ago. Something's clearly changed in the last few weeks, the last month, and in the last week here in Olympia. Women are much more comfortable speaking about their experiences. There are women who are only willing to talk on background, to not let us identify them 5 or 6 days ago, who are now going on the record. I mean, things have changed this week in the last few days. And yes, there are other women in the story we've just published online at KUOW.org who are saying that they too were inappropriately touched and got unwanted attention from Jim Jacks at the time. I want to note that we requested that Jim Jacks respond to this. He finally did this morning, and I think it's only fair that I read a little bit of his statement.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote to me this morning, Mr. Jenkins, this is my only statement regarding this subject. Quote, I deeply regret my actions that were inappropriate during my tenure as a state legislator. I think the conversations today about workplace harassment are important and necessary and can create lasting change. I want those safeguards for my family, my wife and children. He also went on to say that he has maintained continuous sobriety. He said he was an alcoholic at the time, and he's attributing his behavior to his use of alcohol back in 2011, at least for that event that led him to resign.
How aware were people in state house leadership?
It depends on who you ask. The former chief clerk, Barbara Baker, the former chief of staff, Mike Ryard, told me that they did not know the details of the sexual harassment that this former legislative assistant was alleging. They said they thought this was more about a hostile work environment. They said they didn't find out until she was quitting her job and that it was kind of too late at that point. But Barbara Baker, also, who was the chief clerk at the time, also said that from that experience, they changed the way that they handled these allegations. And she said that they created some mandatory reporting protocols within the state legislature and that they learned from it. That said, you ask just about any woman who works in and around the legislature whether today they would go to the chief clerk's office and report on a sitting lawmaker sexually harassing them, and I'll bet you it's 100% the answer is no.
Do any women say they suffered repercussions for letting somebody know?
What they say is that they don't trust that the system is built to protect them, that they don't trust that in a political environment where majorities matter, where the integrity of the institution matters, where people are political appointees, even if they're good, willing people, that the system is designed to help somebody who feels that an elected official has misbehaved. There just isn't trust in the system, and I think that's evidenced by what the Seattle Times reported today, which is that the House says that the formal complaint process has been used once in the last decade.
And this is a very unique work environment. You were telling us yesterday about what it's like under the dome. You have these power imbalances and weird working situations.
Absolutely. You've got young people working with elected officials. You've got lobbyists, many of whom are young women who are trying to get their own businesses and careers going, who need access to these lawmakers. And any time a lawmaker uses their position of power to leverage access, it puts these women in an absolutely impossible situation, because their job, as one lobbyist told me this week, is when a lawmaker says they want to meet with you, you go meet with them. Right? You've got your clients you're working on behalf of. So what if that invitation is cloaked in something that makes that person uncomfortable? So we're hearing about women who won't meet with certain lawmakers, bring somebody along, don't meet alone, try to find workarounds. But I also want to be fair, and maybe you're going to get to this. I do want to talk about the work that the House of Representatives right now is doing to look at their policies and procedures. And I also think it's important for context that we've also heard that there's a lot of really good people and a lot of really good men working around here. And it's not necessarily toxic, but that there is this undercurrent, and almost every woman you talk to has a story to tell.
Austin Jenkins reporting, our Olympia correspondent, letting you know some of what we're learning about accusations against legislators, lobbyists, and more in Olympia. And We'll keep reporting on this, I know, Austin, and please keep us up to date and come back on the show, will you?
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks, Austin. You're listening to The Week in Review. We're all listening to this together. Joni Balter, Natalie Brand, C.R. Douglas. Any reaction?
Well, I think it's interesting what he just said there about almost every woman has a story. So we featured the Me Too movement, which is so powerful. It's bringing so many people forward. And you have these sexual harassment claims going viral in almost every industry, including Olympia. So we had Mona Locke on, and she has quite a story to tell. Maybe she's been on KUOW as well.
This is the former journalist and former wife of former governor Gary Locke.
Right. And so while we were talking about this, we also had a professor on from the University of Puget Sound. Mona Locke said, you know, almost every person has a story. So we turned to the audience and said, show of hands. And I swear to you, I've never seen anything like it. Of like 100 people, pretty much everyone, maybe there were a few hands that did not go up. Now, maybe they self-selected to come talk about this. That's possible. But I think this really is a big moment in all of this, because Me Too is empowering people to say things that they have held to themselves for a very, very long time. And also this time around on this, because there's so many industries involved, it really has consequences. NPR lost its leader.
Senior Vice President for News resigned from NPR.
Resigned, and it went kind of quickly, and sort of hats off to NPR in that regard, that it happened quickly now that it became public. House of Cards, done.
Kevin Spacey.
I tell you, Weinstein Company is not long for this world. Mm. So it has consequences as well.
It's amazing that it's...
By the way, I just want to say, I think I conflated. I said that Mona Locke married to. Gary Locke, former governor. Mona Locke, I may have called her a former journalist. She may be currently a journalist, yes.
Oh, well.
So, anyway, I just wanted to.
Known journalist, yeah.
Yes. What do you think, Natalie?
I think it's amazing that it's taken until 2017 to reach this point. The question that remains is, does this spur culture change, like legitimate culture change, other than raising awareness? We've already seen immediate impact of different individuals resigning. But, I mean, this is a movement that's actually been decades in the making. If we go back to even a famous case in this state involving Carrie Tupper, back in the 1980s, filed a police report against former Washington Senator Brock Adams, a case that never made it to court, but it was actually the Seattle Times reporting in 1992 with eight additional women coming forward that really kind of proved that when you have a critical mass of alleged victims, accusers coming forward, it can really make impact.
Well, interestingly, the executive editor of the paper, Dave Boardman, wrote a piece recently for Philly.com wondering, is this the tipping point moment for this in our culture? And sort of wondering why in 1992, when the Seattle Times broke that exact story, everyone thought that was the tipping point, but clearly it was not.
I think it is the tipping point, and I think the Weinstein story, which is only 4 weeks old, did change things. I mean, look at the dominoes that have fallen since then.
Why was it Weinstein that changed things so much?
I think this is the reason. And you're right. We've had other examples, both locally, but also nationally, of women actually even coming forward, claims against powerful men, sexual harassment allegations. I think the difference is this time that it's famous people making the accusations. If you look at, for instance, Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, it's a very high-profile accusation. It didn't change the culture dramatically like we're seeing now. The allegations against Bill Clinton didn't really change the culture. Even the allegations against Trump more recently didn't change the culture. These were women, earnest, well-meaning women, but not famous women, who were coming forward. The difference here, and like it or not, celebrity matters. Mm-hmm. When Angelina Jolie, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Ashley Judd come forward, they are immediately listened to and they are immediately believed. And that is what changed things.
Was it Alyssa Milano who initially asked for the hashtag Me Too? You're right, though. It is when Hollywood gets involved or has a place in this debate. It just amplifies the message to an extreme.
I agree with you, but I also don't think it's just that they're famous. I think it's the preponderance of cases that have come up and the number of people who are saying they are affected. So Harvey Weinstein's story started with 13, went to 30. It's like at 80 or something like that now of people who came forward. And then you go to all the legislatures and you go, you know, wherever you go, and you've got all these powerful people falling and women who say, well, I've been sitting on this one for a long time, and then one comes forward through Me Too, and others come and say Me Too.
Some of the men are famous as well. Dustin Hoffman, right. Jeremy Piven, Mark Halperin from NBC, mm-hmm. celebrity chef John Besh, director James Toback. And there's a spectrum here from, you know, comments to rape, and I don't mean to put all these men at the same place on that spectrum, but it's a lot of well-known names.
And we've never seen anything like it. I mean, in 4 weeks, look at what has happened. And you mentioned just a few of the people who have fallen, if you will. I mean, this fuse was lit, I believe, by these famous accusers of Weinstein, which really got this started. But I do want to acknowledge that the culture was getting agitated too. I mean, listen, it took a culture to be ready for this also. And we have learned a lot. We've gotten a lot more savvy about this. We've seen a lot more of the examples of it. So it's partly it took time, but it took the right people to light the fuse.
And I think for it to have really lasting impact, it needs to be a topic and a movement that's embraced not only by women saying Me Too, women and men saying Me Too, but by the men who don't think that they have ever committed any sort of harassment.
Yeah, we got Justin Farrell said something similar about how that could happen in Olympia. And I may have to move that into my little document here. Yes, Joni.
Can I cover for you here?
Sure. So here's what Justin Farrell told me about that.
Not just to have rules and regulations and some kind.
She's saying that you know what you're saying about men. She said there's plenty of men in Olympia who treat women with respect, and those men need to go public.
Not just to have rules and regulations and some kind of disciplinary process, which are often really, really hard for women to go through. But a real culture shift where men are really stepping up and saying, and we're not going to tolerate this. There are a lot of public platforms in Olympia, you know, in the State of the Union address, for example, from the governor, something like that, where, you know, someone could say, we're not tolerating this anymore publicly. I think that would be very powerful.
So at Civic Cocktail, we kept Mayor Tim Burgess on just so it wasn't only women speaking to it. We asked him, he's the father of three daughters, to speak to how, you know, how men who do support women, who don't do this, how they would respond. One thing that we did ask, and I think it's interesting, although there'll be blowback possibly for this, is can it go too far? Can Me Too go too far? So I do worry, and there was an LA Times column about this topic, what happens when we air this, and then there's backlash to that. You know, pendulums always swing on these things.
Gone too far, meaning
you can't flirt. You can't flirt in the workplace. You can't meet anybody. How far does this go to policing the behavior?
Well, Woody Allen was talking about a witch hunt atmosphere.
The last person I would call up.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But do you see any signs of overzealousness? Are we anywhere near that?
I think the cases that we're talking about in the media are serious allegations, and we're hearing apologetic statements from the men, the individuals who have resigned, from the NPR chief, from Mark Halperin. It's interesting to see statements, even the one that Austin Jenkins just read, acknowledgement that this was bad behavior that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, very few are denying it.
Yeah, Harvey Weinstein.
He's about the only one.
Yeah.
Some of it sounds
but
like.
But then, even in that one clip, brief interview with him, he said, "I need help."
Yeah, that's true.
Their statements to me sound like lawyer boilerplate. Like, you have to say this because, you know, when the lawsuit comes, it's going to be, you better do something conciliatory here.
Just a comment on the male aspect of this. I do think it's important that this becomes not a male-female divide, but a harassers and harass shamers divide, if you will. And I do think more men, honorable men, non-harassing men, ought to be coming forward and helping these women. And I'm not saying they're not, but I just hope that continues going forward. And one point about what Joni brings up, you know, America loves to go to extremes. And I think there probably will be segments that go too far on this. I mean, there.
What would that be?
You can imagine a lot of well-meaning men that are not doing anything malicious. I mean, some of the stuff
we hear here is super
malicious, and they're raping, and they're inappropriate, and it's pretty clear it was intentional, but. There'll be comments. We're going to be learning what the lines are on this one.
Joni, are you being sarcastic when you say that's a pretty dress?
No,
or are you
I'm saying
you're troubled by.
I'm just asking where I want the pendulum to swing on this. I want this behavior to change. I want this to be the tipping point moment because so many other times we thought it was and it wasn't. But all of that said, I wonder what men are thinking now. They're the ones that are like, can I not say this? Can I not do that? So I'm only being partly facetious with
that. But I think the other part of this, too, that we have to talk about is it highlights the difficulty of victims or led victims to come forward. That's something that we've been reporting even before the Me Too movement is, as Carrie Tepper said back when I talked to her recently, referring back to her case, there's no such thing as a good victim. They are, under the microscope just as much as the accused in this case.
Absolutely. But the fact is, there are false accusations. I mean, there have been false accusations of rape. There have been false accusations of assault, throughout our history. So, you know, we got to be mindful that not everything that is alleged does necessarily happen. And I'm sure
also pointing out what percentage we think we're talking about, you know, when we say false allegations. It's a big difference to say it happens or to suggest that it's ubiquitous.
But you could see this getting out of hand. You could see this getting out of hand. Someone who doesn't get a job that they wanted says, and by the way, when we were doing the job interview, he interviewing me, she said something inappropriate. You can see it. It could get out of hand.
You know, I loop this back to the sheriff's race. You know, there is a allegation of rape against the sheriff, very serious, happened in, I think, 2002 is when the date was. The allegation came out much more recently, but so you want to listen to that, you want to be mindful of it, but it's also true that it has been looked at by, you know, the county prosecutors, you know, Seattle police, the FBI, they've all deemed it to be not credible and didn't prosecute it. So, you know, it's tricky.
And we have a criminal justice system, due process, that is obviously critical to keep in mind. But then there's also the court of public opinion. I think where there is agreement is when individuals in some of these high profile cases have started speaking negatively about the victim, we're now seeing backlash from the community, from other elected leaders, you know, from victims' advocates groups. That is something that we've started seeing this year amplified.
Are you including the former Seattle mayor, Ed Murray,
who denies
all the allegations completely and got a lot of blowback for denigrating.
But you are absolutely judged for the way that you handle. Let's say you are accused of something. You are absolutely judged for the way that you respond. What you could do or should do is talk about what you did, not about all the things you don't like about the person accusing you.
Another former state representative, Democratic representative from Vancouver, Jim Moeller, wrote on Facebook, quote, "All I ask is that we take a view that we are not ourselves when we drink, and there but for the grace of God go I." I'm still reading. This is not given as an excuse, but as a point of context.
Well, that was in one of your cases there in Olympia where they said, you know, I don't drink anymore, so I'm good now. I was bad then.
That's
right?
What Jim Jack said.
Yeah, I'm not super sympathetic to that. I don't think drinking is something you can hide behind. And you do have some of these cases which are trying to hide behind drinking.
And if it gets to that point, you shouldn't be drinking that much, or you need to address that underlying issue.
Yeah.
It's not an excuse.
So do you think you're going to see, we talked about what could make this more than a blip and something in the news cycle. Justin Farrell mentioned, well, it'd be nice for the governor to elevate this to the level of that this belongs in the State of the Union speech, whether it's that or something else. What do you hope to see, expect to see that you'll think, yeah, you know what, things are changing?
Well, what I'd like to see is HR departments in business. I'd like to see Tim Burgess spoke of city policy, but I'd like to hear more about, do the policies work? Do people come forward if they have an ombudsman or a person who deals with this? And if your system isn't working, and a really good, clear look at whether it is or isn't, make the changes. Tell people and tell people about it. Some folks were talking about education for employees, and X% of employees have now been through the sensitivity training on this. What can you do and what can't you do? Let's draw some clear lines and then tell people what they are.
By the way, very quickly, I talked to someone who trains on sexual harassment and violence against women. He said, stop calling it sensitivity training. Okay. That makes everybody's eyes roll. It's leadership training. Mm-hmm. And that, for one thing, that speaks to values that men are more likely to step up to than I should be more sensitive, but I should be a leader. Well, what are my values, and then am I doing anything about it?
It takes leadership to call out another coworker's behavior. Say, you know what, that crossed the line. That was an inappropriate comment or, you know, behavior. You need to stop that.
Yeah, and I think you're going to get rules changes. I do think there'll be changes in Olympia. We already heard some of the reforms that they're talking about that Austin brings up. But ultimately, you can't rule your way to this solution. You can't law your way to this solution. It takes the culture and attitudes to change, and that takes time, but it's certainly starting.
But speaking up and speaking out is the first step, I would say.
Natalie Brand, Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, I'm Bill Radke. We're going to take a break and then wrap up the week in review, so stick around. Okay, just a couple of minutes left. Sounders did what they were supposed to do, advance in the playoffs. The biggest Sounder fan coworker I have is Kara McDermott, who's also a social media producer during Week in Review. Hi, Kara, what happened?
Well, we had the second leg of the playoffs with Vancouver last night, and it was home. And we had 20 minutes of a deluge of rain, and then the skies cleared a little bit, and we got two goals, which was enough to put us into the Western Conference Championship.
Which happens when?
We are going to play two games also. Again, on the 21st and on the 30th.
2018?
Feels like that.
It's like 3 weeks away.
Oh, we love our playoffs to last for like 2 months in this country.
That's true.
But okay. The real tricky thing is we don't know who our opponent's going to be. It depends on what happens this Sunday. It could be a showdown between our arch rival Portland.
That's
if
what
they
we
come
want.
Out that ahead gets, against Houston.
That gets hot and heavy, doesn't it?
One more sports note. Last weekend, thank you, Kara, for the update. Last weekend, the UW unveiled a statue of former head football coach Don James, or as your TV station called him, Natalie, legendary coach Don James. Everybody calls him that. Why is he legendary?
Because he did so well.
You mean he was a successful coach?
Absolutely.
Paul Bunyan is legendary. I was a Husky student when Don James was coaching there. This is not a legend when I tell you he coached some very good teams that won more games than they lost. Not really a legend. But we can't resist making things sound like more than they are. I just Googled the word slams and looked at the headlines. Former DNC chair slams Hillary Clinton. Trump slams Bo Bergdahl's sentence. Trump slams U.S. courts. Trump slams Sessions. Sessions slams visa lottery. No, they didn't slam. They just said things. They may have criticized somebody. But it's clickbait, and I'm telling you, it's leaked into our conversation. You're not slammed at work. You're just busy, okay? And if you have a desk job, you're probably not that busy. You're not crashing at work. You're just working. You're not going to grab lunch. You're just going to eat. So for the next week, I suggest we challenge ourselves to say, I'm not going to jump in the shower and throw on some clothes and take off. I'm just going to take a shower, and then I'm going to go to work. We're not that dynamic. If you want an exciting life, do actual exciting things. That's what I wanted to tell you.
This is a tirade against action verbs.
Yeah. Action verbs. I don't like action verbs.
And I don't buy it.
You're on fire. You're on fire
deadline
today.
All the time.
Yeah.
We are a slam.
Do you realize that slams, you know, five
you can't take
words,
slam away from us,
letters.
Bill. Don't take slam away.
Don't take. You already took progressive. Come on.
All right. We got to go. We're slammed. Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Natalie Brand. Great to see you. Election deadline. Get that ballot in. Thanks for listening.